All right, so I thought I would start by seeing whether any of you who read cases towards the end that we didn't get to had particular points that you wanted to discuss, and then I'll go on to discuss a bunch of other stuff. So did any of the people, I guess the last few, there's a McHenry and Strasser had some, and Nightingale and Velarde, and I think that finished them. Did you have cases that interested you? Ah, you did. All right, so.
Yeah.
All right. Then I hadn't marked exactly where we stopped last time. All right. Yes?
I'm not sure if that's something I was thinking, but I was wondering about one reason that people who report up their elders might be able to bend their system. So the reason was that I thought might be because. Then it's a way for
them to make payment, as it were, for having offended against the norms.
Right.
On the other hand, I think it's also the case that the elders don't get charged under those circumstances, if I remember the rule correctly, in which case it doesn't work very well.
Oh, they don't get charged at all?
I think that's right. I am not certain that's right, but I think that's right. I'd have to check. All right. Since I wrote the chapter on Chinese law, I discovered some more sources. One source, which I mentioned briefly in there and I wanted to say a little bit about, which I think is on reserve if you want to look at it, I don't think I had any assignment in it, is a book by Van Gulik, translation by Van Gulik. Van Gulik is a Dutch sinologist. If you want to have fun getting a picture of Imperial Chinese law, I recommend the Judge D books, which are crime, they're detective stories written by Van Gulik based on period Chinese material but not straight translations, set in Imperial China, and they're good stories. Judge D is the district magistrate. He's the Sherlock Holmes figure in traditional Chinese mystery literature, apparently. Van Gulik, who was a Dutch, I think he was a diplomat of some sort, but he was also a sinologist. And at some point, he was upset over the fact that young Chinese and Japanese students were reading translations of junky third-rate Western mysteries and didn't know that there was a whole literature of Chinese mysteries they were missing. And they decided to do something about it. And so he published one book that was basically translation, except I think he was putting together chunks from two different old books. And then he wrote a bunch that were essentially original, but using ideas and themes from the literature. So that's a lot of fun. But he also translated this rather weird book, 13th century, so much earlier than what we're looking at, which is a bunch of cases apparently intended as instruction for people who are going to be magistrates. So these are sort of, this is what this very clever magistrate did in this case, take it as an example. And they're more nearly detective stories than legal disputes. Some of them are stories about clever ways of finding out who was guilty, which is a genre that seems to exist in many different cultures. So that whose cow is it? Let it loose, and which herd does it go to? Or who looks upset when it's injured? And some of you probably know the famous story about Solomon and the baby, the question of two mothers who claim the baby is both theirs, and Solomon says, all right, we'll cut it in half, and each of you get half of it. And, of course, the mother says, well, in that case, give it to her as the real mother, since she's the one who doesn't want her baby cut in half. There's another Solomon story that I came across. This is out of Islamic literature, that a man went to Sulaiman ibn Daud, king and prophet, and he said, Solomon, one of my neighbors has been stealing my geese, but I don't know which one. And so Sulaiman said, I will take care of it. And the next day, when the people were assembled at prayer, Sulaiman said, one of you is so wicked that not only has he been stealing his neighbor's geese, he has come to prayers with geese feathers in his hair. And one of the people reached up to feel his hair. So that's a sort of a genre, and that shows up in this one as well. And some of them are what we would think of as forensic science, recognizing that what claimed to be an ancient document had actually been made ancient by staining with tea, as you could tell by the fold lines in one of the stories. One of the things it turns out that documentary evidence is very important for is land claims, who owns property. Tricks for getting criminals to reveal themselves. Some of them, a few of them, are cases on actual rulings on what the law is. So, for example, the stepmother kills the father, and the son then kills the stepmother. So the argument is, since the stepmother is close relative, son's horrible crime. Ah, says the judge, that's wrong. Once the father is dead, the stepmother is no longer a relative of the son. After all, the only relationship is through the marriage. Therefore, it's just an ordinary murder, and he only gets the punishment for an ordinary murder, not the punishment for killing a parent, which is much worse. Another case where a robber kills two parents and a son. It takes the son a day to die. There is then an inheritance question. The married daughter claims that she gets the inheritance as the only survivor, but the judge says that since the son died after the others, he inherited when his parents died, therefore his heirs get the property. So that's sort of a technical point of inheritance law. A general attitude, I should have brought the book because it was a neat passage, but I didn't, that you're guilty until proven innocent, that if you hadn't, even if you didn't commit this crime, if you hadn't done something wrong, you wouldn't have gotten into trouble. And I'm reminded, I don't know if I've told you the story about when I and Steve Schulhofer at Chicago wrote an article arguing for a voucher system for indigent criminal defendants. Have I told that story in this class? No. Steve Schulhofer was a professor at Chicago, and he came to me with an idea. And the idea was that under our current system, indigent felony defendants are entitled to have a court-provided attorney. But that attorney is being chosen not by them, but by the court, which means that in a majority of all American felony trials, both lawyers are working for the same side, at least in the literal sense of who is paying them. That is to say, the defendant's lawyer is either somebody appointed by the judge or a public defender being paid by tax money, which is the same source from which the prosecutor is being paid, or several other systems. Judge also, yeah. And so Steve's idea was lots of complaints about the system in terms of they're not providing enough money to get decent lawyers. That may be one problem, but a different problem is who is the lawyer really loyal to, and that therefore what you ought to do instead is to say, here is the money available, the defendant gets to pick his own lawyer, voucher system. And it was entertaining partly because Steve was regarded as on one end of the political spectrum at Chicago, and I was regarded as the other end of the political spectrum, and here we were co-authoring an article. And the question, of course, was which of us had subverted which. And I thought that question was answered when we gave a talk in the law and econ workshop on this, and I heard Steve Schulhofer explaining to Judge Posner about the virtues of the free market. But in any case, yep.
How would you identify your political
stance? I'm a libertarian. I'm an extreme libertarian. Steve, I don't know, liberal. You know, fairly far left liberal, I guess. Okay. I don't know. I didn't know in detail. I know that was how he was thought of, at least. But I agreed with him. I mean, you know, he was right that if you are going to provide that, it makes sense to have the person be the one who decides who the lawyer is. Anyway, but one of the interesting bits in terms of the arguments was that Posner at one point was arguing that it is true this might give you better defense, but better defense wasn't really a desirable thing anyway. It made it harder to convict people, that the people who were indigents charged with felonies were pretty much always guilty. They might not always be guilty of the particular felony they were charged with, but the police knew who the criminals were, essentially, was the line he was offering. And that I'm sort of reminded of by this. He might be right, of course, I don't know, but somewhat cynical view of the system. Also reminds me, for those of you who know the movie Casablanca, Round Up the Usual Suspects is one of the lines in that movie. But in any case, there is this sort of attitude. Torture is routinely used in the cases, and what seems to be going on is that you can't convict without a confession. And that's a pattern that you also see in Europe in medieval and Renaissance times. Some limits on what torture is legitimate, and presumably there are problems if people die under torture. I think in the Chinese system there are problems for the judge if the person dies under torture. But nonetheless, it is being used. At the same time, and this goes back to a point that we saw in the case of the Athenian law, people did realize the problem with interrogation under torture, which is that people will confess to things they haven't done. And in this 13th century compilation, there are a number of cases where what the clever magistrate does is to realize that the defendant who has confessed is really innocent, only confess because of the torture and then figure out who really did it. So in that sense, again, as in our other sources, it's not they didn't see the problem, it was they presumably thought that despite the problem, it was the best solution they had. Alright, so those are some of the things. But as I say, the book, I forget what it's called, but it's by Van Gulik, because the translator, and I'm pretty sure I put it on reserve. If not, I've got a copy at home I can lend you if anybody wants to read it. It's sort of fun. It's hard to know if they're real cases. That is, it's hard to know if these really happened or if these are sort of traditional stories that the judges and lawyers tell, but at least they're put in the form of cases. The Tang Code, if you want to look at it, I had a link to that on the syllabus. It's something you could read from. But the basic bottom line, other than the fact that it's sort of an alternative to Body and Morris for getting a view of the legal system, is that it isn't very different. It's 1,000 years earlier. All right, the Tang Dynasty starts in 600 and something, and I think the Qin is about 1600, roughly. I don't remember the exact dates. So you've roughly got a 1,000-year gap, and I think the estimate somewhere is that of the Qin code, 40% of it is lifted from the Tang code. And certainly when you read both codes, the general, it feels like the same general system with detailed differences. It's sort of interesting. But the main thing I've been reading for the last few days relevant to this is a book based on material that wasn't available when Body and Morris wrote their book. Because one of the problems with the Body and Morris book is that its cases are all the equivalent of our appeals court cases, or maybe Supreme Court cases. That is to say, they aren't the case of original impression. They are a higher level court ruling on the decisions of a lower level court. And that means that you're getting only a sort of a reflected picture of what the system really was like on the ground. And apparently, yo?
Oh, this is actually, my essay I'm writing on the Ptolemaic law, and at least one scholar classed Ptolemaic Egypt and China as the two examples of what he called the classical bureaucracy. I haven't gone very far into what he means by that, but there are some similarities. And one thing that just sort of came to me just like half a second ago was that there's not a whole lot of Ptolemaic cases because the papyrus that were written on was used to make mummies and stuff like that, so a lot of it's illegible or destroyed, but there's also a ton more. But the point is that there's only a few cases that I know of, actual cases, and as far as I can tell, every one of them is civil, which I found interesting because the other classical bureaucracy is the other side of that coin, where it's all criminal, even though you have an under.
We have a problem of defining civil and criminal, which I'm going to get into in a little while. By civil, do you mean that the subject matter was
property disputes, mostly?
But are they also civil in the sense that, as in our tort case, it is the plaintiff who controls the case as opposed to the magistrate who controls the case?
Well, in the sort of the final case where there's lawyers and stuff like that, it seems like the plaintiff is in charge.
Can the plaintiff settle out of court?
No, the court decided against him, the plaintiff.
But could he have settled out of court before the court decided? Could he have ended the case by saying, all right, so-and-so has agreed to pay me such and such an amount, and we're finished, we're done?
I have no evidence of settlement.
Yeah. Because I'll be getting to that, because one of the issues in the new stuff is that the new book is about civil cases. And the reason I wanted to look at it was that some of the stuff I'd seen about it suggested that it was evidence that my picture of the system was wrong. And it's actually a little more complicated than that, so I'll be getting to in a few minutes. But
there is evidence of like alternate dispute resolution, which could have ended settlements, but I haven't seen any cases that explicitly ended settlements.
After I go through this, think about where it fits into the pattern, because it's going to be the same basic issue, I think. So the new sources show records from the low-level courts, including some courts a court in Taiwan, which is interesting because of the other reading we had about stuff in Taiwan. And unlike the high-level cases, clearly the judges, the magistrates here, are concerned with the facts, that they are doing things like trying to figure out whether a document was forged or not. They are doing things like going to the land in question and looking at the streams that are supposed to be the boundary marks. And there are multiple cases where the judge's conclusion is this case is a fake case, it didn't really happen, he's making a claim he has no right to, and so forth. So in that sense, they look much more like what we would think of as law cases than the ones you've been reading do. Second interesting point is that although the statutes are penal, the actual resolution of the cases that they're looking at, which are in some sense, which are civil in the sense they deal with things like property, usually is not criminal. That is to say, you have a statute which says the penalty for not paying back a loan is so many blows of the light bamboo, depending on how much the money you owed, how long it was since over which you didn't pay it, and so forth. But the actual outcome of most of the cases is pay the loan and we'll forget about the punishment. And it looks as though it's relatively uncommon that they actually impose the statutory penalties. And third point, which helps explain the difference between their view of it and the Body and Morris view, is that, as you may remember, if the punishment was more than bambooing, the case had to be reported up to the next level to be approved, and if it was sufficiently high, up to a higher level than that. But these, what they're referring to as civil cases, are pretty much almost all cases where the highest punishment is bambooing. Hence, they are all cases which only have to be reported up en masse. That is, he's got to say, we've settled such and such a number of cases, but they don't have to report, here is what happened. They don't have to give the kind of reports that we're seeing, what we've been reading. Here is what happened, here's the statute we did it under, and so forth. And the authors argue that on the whole, they were following statute, not with regard to the actual punishments, but in the sense that what was legal or illegal was more or less along the lines of the statutes. They point out that the statutes look less civil than they are. So that, for example, you have a statute on loans which starts out by saying that the maximum interest rate is 3% a month. It then says, furthermore, total interest can never be more than total principal. But then somewhere in the middle of it, it also says, and the penalty for not paying back a loan is such and such. So what appears to be a maximum interest rate rule, probably not enforced, includes the sort of basic rule of you have to pay back money that you owe. So the question is, what does civil mean? And that issue is important for, I think, at least three different issues that arise in looking at Chinese law. One of them is the argument that I made early on, that Iceland gives us a pure tort system and China a pure criminal system. One of them is the chapter on contract law in Taiwan, which I think I assigned you this time, I have in the past, which argues that you had elaborate contractual practice with virtually no contract law. And the third is the argument which a number of people, I think including Boddy and Morris, are making, which is that what we think of as civil issues were normally handled outside of the court by other dispute resolution mechanisms. And what they mean by civil is defined by subject matter. That is to say, their four major categories of what they're calling civil cases are disputes about marriage, disputes about inheritance, disputes about property, and disputes about debt. And typically, the verdicts that they give settle the dispute without imposing the statutory punishment, so that they say, yes, he inherits, or yes, he owes that money to so-and-so, or yes, this piece of land belongs to you and not to him, or it belongs to you and not to him, but you should make a certain payment to him as to compensate him for his claim, things of that sort. And on the other hand, they do seem to fit a general pattern, a pattern of general legal principles of sort of not that, some of them familiar to us, that you're supposed to pay back your debts, rules which, the rule for inheritance, the basic rule is equal division among legitimate sons, where legitimate sons include sons of both wives and concubines who seem to be legally equal, but does not include illegitimate sons who get a half as much as the legitimate sons, so they get some cut. Then there are rules which seem to be quite important about the inheritance of the position of head of the family, that you have family property which somebody is administering on behalf of the family, part of whose purpose, I think, is to provide funds for appropriate religious ceremonies for the memory of the ancestors and maybe other things as well. And there are rules on who inherits that, where the basic rule on who inherits that is the eldest son, but what if you don't have any sons? And then there are various, the basic rule seems to be that there is a default rule among the further relatives, but that the person who was the head within some range gets to choose, so that it's sort of explicit. The basic rule is it's supposed to be a male of your son's generation. So your nephew, for example, would qualify, or else appropriate cousins one generation down from you. And the rule, at least as specified, says if the oldest such person is someone who you don't get along with or you don't trust, then you can give it to someone else. So in that sense, there's some testamentary freedom with regard to the position of head of household, but only if you don't have any male children of your own, any legitimate male children, I think. And various other rules of that general sort. So it's a fairly elaborate system. So in that sense, it's civil in the sense that it's dealing with those matters. On the other hand, I think my claim is still correct, because the procedure, as far as I can tell, is what we would think of as a criminal procedure. That is, as far as I can tell, when you haven't paid your debt to me, I don't sue you. I go to the magistrate and says, "Magistrate, noble, honorable father of everybody, please help us because this person has not paid the debt he owes." And the magistrate, in theory, is required to take up the case. The comments in this book are basically the local people didn't believe that they really were, that the local people believed magistrates decided whether to take the case, and that the legal rule was the magistrate could decline to take the case if there was some technical error in the application. Maybe there's some reference to declining it because it deals with matters that should not be aired in public. In theory, sort of, if everything was proper, he had to take it. And this is relevant in part, point I'll be coming back to, because according to this book, in the districts they were looking at, there were very large backlogs of cases. So the magistrates were, in fact, getting more cases than they could handle and didn't like that fact and tried to do various things to deal with it and got blamed by their higher-ups for not doing the magistrate's job of always clearing the docket. Furthermore, it looks as though a sizable majority of all cases that get to the magistrate aren't actually resolved by the magistrate. That is, that they go partway through the procedure and then under one method or another, they're slipped off to some kind of arbitration, and only a minority finally get sentences, so to speak. Furthermore, there are sometimes verdicts which injure both parties. And in that, again, suggests a criminal rather than civil. So that the example that was struck was you had a dispute over property where there are two streams. The documents apparently say the stream is the boundary, but I claim it's this stream, which gives me the land in between, and you claim it's that stream. And the verdict is the land in between the streams is confiscated and will go to have its rent support the local school. So that's not a verdict you would expect in a tort suit. But it's a verdict that makes a certain amount of sense if the magistrate thinks both parties are in some sense at fault or being a nuisance, and it also has the virtue of discouraging other people from going to the magistrate with their cases since they're both worse off. Well, one of them is worse off and one of them is no better off than on any other outcome. So that was sort of, it seemed to me, an interesting point. One of the issues that comes up and is discussed a good deal in this book, one which I mentioned earlier, is the legal trickster issue, the general idea that you're bad people, all of you. I'm not. I'm just a professor. But you people are going to be lawyers. You're training to be legal tricksters to cause trouble for the innocent peasants who you entrap in your wiles, and also to make work harder for the magistrate, which is your real offense, pretty clearly. And that part of what's going on is that, as I was saying, the courts have an overload. The courts want someone to blame. And so the courts report up the hierarchy. The problem is there are all these people who are entrapping the poor innocent peasants into making charges which are mostly bogus anyway, and the peasants get entangled in the law and they're worse off, and we can't deal with all these charges. Got to do something about the legal tricksters. So part of my argument earlier, what I think, it's only the argument in the book, but I think the argument I made here, is that they were deliberately making the legal system unattractive to keep down the number of cases. And I think for the areas that this book is looking at, the answer is yes, they were doing it, but no, it wasn't working. That is to say that it looks as though the locals were frequently trying to game the system, trying to use the legal system to get an advantage in their conflicts with each other in various ways. That a lot of this involves lineages, where you've got a very extended family. I think the lineage, I think, is everybody who has the same name. If I've got it right, you've got subgroups within that, lineages feuding with other lineages, and in the course of this, trying to accuse each other of various offenses. Yeah?
What did the higher-ups say in response?
I don't think that's clear. That is, the stuff we've seen, which is from higher-ups, certainly is very harsh on legal tricksters. So in that sense, they're accepting it. But I think they also are unhappy with the magistrates who aren't doing an adequate job because they aren't settling all the cases that they ought to be doing.
Was there some kind of blame for the magistrates who posted teachers? Maybe have us set up a system where, not a system, but do something outside of settling the students after they start.
Well, there's one case discussed where one of the magistrates has got some scheme to trap tax evaders, and he at least claims that the people responsible for the tax evasion are the same legal tricksters, and he claims that the number of cases in his court dropped in half after he put in jail all of these people. So that's at least someone who's claiming that he's dealing with it in a properly disciplinary kind of manner, but I don't know about other cases. I think it's pretty clear, at least, that their view is that they ought to be able to stop it. Part of what's pretty clear, again, in the book I'm reading, is that the magistrates claim the peasants are victims. But if you look at the evidence, it's quite clear the peasants don't think so. Because what happens, the magistrate says to the peasant, look, I know you didn't draw up this petition to the court. You couldn't have done that. Who did it for you? It was a traveling fortune teller. I never got his name. So that it certainly looks as though the peasants are refusing to betray their legal advisors on whom they depend under pressure by the magistrates trying to make them so the peasants are supposed to be the innocent victims, and it's only the legal tricksters. The legal tricksters, it sounds like, tend to be the people who didn't do well enough in the examinations to become government officials. That is, they're sort of the lower edge of the educated class, as it were, which also sort of makes a certain amount of sense. There were two cases in the cases some of us read which dealt with this at least, which I think were relevant. One of them, page 246-7, somebody who, what was his offense? He prepared public notices announcing plans to establish an office to taxation matters for people and settle their litigation. So he's offering basically to give tax and legal advice. And he gets 100 blows of the heavy bamboo plus 2 years penal servitude. And he is sentenced by analogy to someone who falsely claims to be a headman, even though he isn't, in fact, falsely claiming to be a headman. But presumably, the headmen are the people who are governmentally authorized to give advice to people. And then there's a later case, case 203. What did somebody do? He drafted 5 legal documents for other people. All of them were of an ordinary nature. There was no evidence, this is according to the case, there was no evidence that he conspired with clerks, tricked the ignorant, etc. Therefore, he only got 3 years of penal servitude instead of getting the military exile that would have been the normal penalty for habitual tricksters. Yeah.
So presumably before the rise of legal tricksters, they would have had to get their positions subscribed by scribes, right?
By, presumably by government clerks. That is, you've got various officials of the magistrate who are working for the magistrate. So I guess they would be the people who were supposed to give you advice, but they might not do it. They might charge for it. I think that would be illegal, if I understand it. It's not clear if it's illegal on paper, but it sounds as though it's illegal in practice if you get caught doing it. But also as though it's happening pretty clearly on a large scale. Anyway, so that seemed to be sort of an intriguing bit of this tension between providing the service and not being allowed to provide the service and the attempt to blame it. And you can see that in a sense there's always a kind of tension between the people who are trying to run the legal system to do what they want and the people they're trying to act on who are using the legal system for their own purposes. So you want to prevent murder. I want to get rid of the bad guy who's courting my daughter. So I accuse him of murder. And if I've got enough friends who will lie about some relevant facts, maybe I get him convicted of murder. So you can think of that as sort of a kind of problem, which I am sure exists in our system. If you think about the possibility, for example, of suing somebody for patent infringement, not because he's infringed your patent, but because he's a competitor, and you figure the suit will make life hard for him, and you might win, but even if you lose, it'll slow him down a bit. That's a kind of tension that's going to run through all systems, and one extreme way of trying to deal with it is to say, sorry, you can't get any legal advice except for us, and we won't give you advice to do those things, and therefore we'll control the system in that way. There were a number of other things that struck me in that book that I thought were also worth talking about. One of them was a pattern that we already saw mentioned in the stuff on gypsies, and that's the substitute criminal. So my lineage has a fight with your lineage, and one or two people get killed. And the person in my lineage who actually did the killing is a well-off, important member of the community. He doesn't really want to get tried and maybe get executed or set off for exile or whatever. Ah, that's all right. Some very poor, low-status member of his lineage volunteers to confess to the crime. And the understanding is that if he confesses to the crime, the lineage will provide him the best defense they can. They maybe will bribe witnesses to find some excuse for why he did it. They will pay off the relatives of the people who got killed, so those relatives won't complain that this is the right wrong guy. And if he does get convicted, then his wealthier relatives will make sure that his aged parents are taken care of. They'll take care of his kids. They will do whatever they can while he is off in exile or has gotten executed or whatever has happened to him. So essentially, they are hiring a relative in need to be a substitute defendant. And we saw that, I don't know if you remember, but it's discussed somewhere in the Gypsy Law book, of the same pattern where you have a Gypsy family, one member has committed a crime, some relatively low-status member volunteers to confess to the crime. Part of what's going on is that from the standpoint of the Gypsies, being in a non-Gypsy prison is a horrible experience because non-Gypsy prisons are polluting because the people running those prisons don't know the rules of Marame. They aren't keeping the proper rules. It's sort of if you imagine yourself being in a prison where you had to wade through fecal matter in order to, you know, get something, get anything, and you were always unclean and all the rest of it. And from a religious standpoint, that's their situation. So it's a very bad thing to happen. So it's really generous of you to volunteer to take it on behalf of your grandfather who would otherwise have to do it. And then when you do finally get out, everybody will reward you suitably in whatever ways are practical within that society. So I thought it was intriguing to see the same pattern existing. And I was trying to figure out to what extent you had an equivalent of that and any equivalence of that in our legal system. And I can't think of a clear case. The closest one that comes to mind is the idea in tort law of I'm a company that's planning to do something which could possibly result in very large tort damages. So I subcontract it to another company which has very few assets and try to arrange so that if there's a suit, they'll get sued instead of us getting sued. Their getting sued isn't so serious because all they can do is go bankrupt. They don't have very much to lose, whereas we could lose a whole lot of money. So if you think of that, sort of one of the things people worry about in our tort system is the idea of looking for deep pockets, that you don't sue the person who's really responsible, you sue the person who has the most money. And you can think of the opposite side as trying to arrange for shallow pockets, as trying to structure your activities in such a way that if somebody does get sued, it'll be somebody who doesn't have much money. But are there any better cases? Can you think of cases in our legal system, either legal or, as in this case, illegal but common, in which one person is in effect confessing to a crime or tort he didn't commit in order to get the person who did commit off? Do we know of such cases? No. Yeah?
You know, I'm wondering why. I mean, how those people who volunteered to be defendants know that they're going to be taken care of.
I presume the answer is that these people are all relatives, they all know each other, and if they and their parents were not taken care of, it would be seen as a shameful act, and the people responsible would lose status. I think that's...
So what about the gypsy?
Oh, the gypsy case. It's all in one family.
Oh, okay. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
I think the various, you know, mafia organizations have something like that. I mean, even if, you know, you didn't have this, if you were volunteering to be a defendant, if the wrong person was arrested and accused, they would not protest. They would just, you know, take the place at trial rather than point the finger at the record because of the whole America thing.
I don't know. I don't know enough about... I'm sort of suspicious of everything said about organized crime because I think the incentives to generate information are pretty bad. That it tends to be either the information is coming from the police who have their own access to grind or from reporters who want to make a good story of it. There is scholarly research on at least the Italian, the Sicilian mafia, which I know of, and I don't remember whether it discusses that question or not. But... Oops, it occurs to me. Did I turn on my phone? I don't always remember to turn on my recorder. I managed to miss one thing last week. So, is this running? Yes, it's running. All right. I did remember this time. So, other things that struck me in that book. One of them, which really is somewhat relevant to this whole question of how business matters were handled, is that there were officially appointed commercial middlemen. So I'm from one city, I want to buy or sell to something in another city, there is somebody who's government authorized, who I'm supposed to go to find me the trading partners. And he's supposed to keep a record of the transaction, which is going to be useful in case I owe taxes, or there is some later dispute about who owns something or whatever. So you do have a sort of a government intervention in the what are basically market transactions. Something else that was interesting, because again, it paralleled something we observed in a different legal system, is the sale of land with an option to repurchase. And this is something that shows up in the Jewish law. So the basic idea is that I've got land and I need money. And one thing you could imagine my doing is borrowing money with the land as security. But the form in which it's done in both of those systems is that I sell you the land, but the terms of the sale are that I may repurchase the land for the price for which I sold it to you in the future. So therefore, it's in effect, it's a mortgage except that you're getting the income from the land during this period, which you're controlling. So in a sense, you could argue that the interest on the mortgage is the revenue from the land. All right? And in the Jewish case, they may have been doing this in part because charging interest to a fellow Jew was forbidden under the law. Whereas this would get you the de facto equivalent. I don't know in the Chinese case, but in the Chinese case is described as exactly the same institution that I'm selling, almost exactly. I'm selling you the land with the right to repurchase. And I think there's a time limit on it, because what the rules describe is that if the point comes when I'm supposed to repurchase and I can't, the result is not that the land goes to you directly. The result is that if you want the land without the option of repurchase, you must pay me an amount, and it sounds as though it's something like a court or somehow neutrally defined amount, which is the difference between the present market price of the land and the amount that I sold it to you. So I've, in effect, sold it to you for less than its full price, because after all, I'm keeping the option to buy it back, which reduces its value to you. And now you've got to pay the rest of that amount if you want the land for it. So that was sort of an interesting system. It sounded as though a lot of this shows up in the courts because you have disputes over either ownership or taxes, and those disputes connect with complicated structures of ownership. That is to say, you own the land, but I've got the right to redeem it, and she's cultivating it, renting it from you, and you have then complicated issues of who owes what to whom, which the court has to deal with. And I came across something quite interesting in the process of looking at this and trying to get information about some of this, which is the Islamic solution to the problem. That Islamic law, I think, is even more stringent than Jewish law. Because Jewish law, I believe, only forbids loans in interest to fellow Jews. Whereas I think the usual interpretation of Islamic law is that interest is riba and riba is forbidden.
So how is it there are all these Islamic banks around, of which there are quite a large number, which have some tens of billions of assets? And apparently one of the ways in which they evade the restriction against interest goes as follows. You want to buy a house. The house costs $100,000. The bank buys the house for $100,000 and sells it to you for $150,000. However, you don't have to pay immediately. You're allowed to stretch out your payments over time. So what it's really done is to lend you the $100,000 to buy your house with, and then collect an interest, another $50,000 of interest spread out over 20 years or whatever, in the difference between the two prices. And that apparently, my impression is that there are some Muslims who think that's a cheat, which it obviously is, but that the relevant authorities have ruled that this is a legitimate way of doing business in the Islamic world, and therefore that so-called Islamic banks, or Sharia-compliant banks, I think is the term they're using, are allowed to do it. And it intrigued me partly because you see this, you see versions of the same pattern in medieval Europe. That in medieval Europe, also interest is illegal. As you may or may not know, usury in modern usage means high interest rates. In most of the historical context, it means any interest at all. And so there were various medieval, both Christian and Muslim, legal devices that people came up with, such as you make a transaction, one end of it is in one currency and one end is the other currency. And since they aren't the same currency, you can't actually say whether you're getting paid back the same amount you gave. I lend you money in florins and you agree to pay me back in a year in numisma. We set it up in such a way that our expectation is that you're giving me 10% interest. But it's possible that in the intervening time, the exchange rate between florins and numisma might change, so it's not as if you've got an actual guarantee. Yeah?
But yeah, that's where, you know, Jews came in, you know, in Europe, and I think in the Islamic world, you know, is it, you know, a Muslim couldn't charge a Muslim interest, you know, or a Christian couldn't charge a Christian interest, but a Jew could charge a Christian interest, or a Jew could charge a Muslim interest, so wealthy people would hire Jews, basically, and you know, forward money to them, so
that's one way of doing it, but the other way of doing it is that a Christian loans a Christian money at something that really is interest but is using a legal device to conceal it, just as the modern cases I'm describing. So part of what's fun is seeing these things showing up, you know, in Abu Dhabi and Iran in the 21st century, that these same issues still exist. There are still strong economic reasons to want to make loans and interest, and there's still this embarrassing fact that the Quran, at least as it's usually interpreted, forbids it.
I wonder if there's a difference, or they see it as there being an ethical difference between the actual straight-up loan and interest and your book amount. Have you seen anything that in the case of the...
As far as I can tell, it looks to me as though there are some purists who say there is not a difference. Mm-hmm. And then there are the sort of more official people who say, well, yes, it's legitimate, but I'm not an insider on those disputes, so I'm sure I can see any more than that. One other thing which I noticed reading this newer book, and which goes back to a much more general issue of mine, which is the question of feud law, and that is that it covers the case of self-help. It covers the case where you loan me some money, or sorry, you owe me some money. You don't pay, so I seize some of your property in instead. And the basic rule seems to be I'm not allowed to do that. I'm supposed to receive a certain number of strokes of the bamboo if I do that. But if I only seize the amount you really owed me, then I can be freed from the strokes of the bamboo for a modest monetary fine. And keep the stuff I seized. So it looks as though it isn't quite approving of private self-help, but it isn't wholly disapproving of it either. And that intrigues me because it sort of suggests a survival of what I argue I see evidence for in the Jewish law and the Islamic law and in things like Icelandic and Irish. The Irish is very explicit and detailed. The Irish, when you owe me money and I seize property, I've got to go through a formal procedure, but the procedure ends up with my taking possession of some of your cows in payment if you don't pay off what you owe. So that was sort of an interesting element. Common, and again, sometimes I think you can deduce things by what's not allowed, by what's allowed. I mentioned in the Jewish case the fact that the avenger of blood is not allowed to accept monetary payment to let off the killer, on the one hand, it tells us what the rule was then, but it also suggests that they expected people to want to do that, and therefore that at some point, at some time and place in the past, it had been legitimate behavior. And similarly, I think here. All right, I think that lists the things that I wanted to say from that particular book. And before I go on to my various lengthy notes on the stuff we've been reading, let me stop just for a minute and see whether there are questions you have or points you wanted to raise. I should point out, by the way, I noticed in a conversation with somebody before things started, at least one student who didn't seem to have noticed that you were supposed to have read parts of the body in Morris' book, which is in the syllabus. I hope you have read it, because that's sort of the framework for a good deal of what we've been talking about. Aside from your assigned cases, there were several chapters that you were assigned to read prior to those cases. That book is on reserve in the library. It's not, unfortunately, in print. You could probably get it for $200 or something, but I wouldn't advise that.
What's the title of that book?
Law and Imperial.
It's on Hine online. You can see a PDF.
Did you
of all of it?
Yeah.
Oh, you did find one?
I did. It's on Hine.
All right, I looked and didn't. Hine is H-E-I-N?
Hine online is what it's called. It's huh. Libraries, like online. I tried finding it, though.
And do you have to get it through our library?
Yeah. Well, you just go on the SU library website.
Right. All right. If I ever teach this course again, I will discover. I will have to make that note, because that would make life much easier for everybody. Because I have one very ragged copy of it in the library, and in our library, I have one copy. So I will probably remember that. But anyway, so it's pretty clear from the stuff I've been reading that as of 15 years ago, it was the sort of latest best source for information about Chinese law, and that now stuff that's been coming since then says, well, yes, this is a great book, but they just didn't have some of the sources we have, and we can now correct some of their misunderstandings. And so it's sort of interesting in that sense, seeing how the field has developed. But as I say, I think my claim is still correct, that it's still the case that it was fundamentally a criminal system without the equivalent of tort law, but it was a criminal system in which people used the criminal system to vindicate private rights, to try to prevent you from stealing my land or make sure that I got the inheritance I was entitled to or things of that sort. So cases were being initiated by parties and not just as part of the crime. All right. So one of the... I have sort of a list of interesting issues that I think come up looking at the system. And one of them is, to what degree was the punishment for an offense determined by the law, and to what degree by the court? That is, if you think of there's sort of this concept of rule of law rather than man in modern law, and it's pretty clear that it's never wholly true in any system because we don't have computers actually running it. And so you can look at the Chinese law and see how much of it was true. And on the one hand, on paper, it was a very rigid system. Each offense is described in detail, and here is the assigned punishment. But there seem to be a lot of exceptions. One of them I just mentioned a little while earlier, and that is, if you look at what's actually happening in the local courts in the cases they don't have to report up the hierarchy, what they are doing is getting what they think is the right verdict, and then generously, in effect, letting off the defendant from getting the beating that he's entitled to get. That it is supposed to be properly humble and apologetic and recognize that he was in the wrong and do all the things associated with his earning that sort of thing. So that's one variation. Then there are about three different ways in which the judge can get a penalty not specified by statute. One of them is by analogy, that he can say, well, actually this exact offense isn't described, but it's sort of like that offense. And sort of like that offense, but worse, so we have the same punishment a little higher, sort of like that offense, but not quite so bad, same punishment a little bit lower. Sort of like that offense, that it would be absurd to say that this one doesn't get as good a punishment as that, so give them the same punishment. Yeah?
And then there's a couple of weird, really far-off ones. Like in Lang, there was a case where it was sort of like great bodily injury when they robbed somebody, when the person just tied a handkerchief around the person's eyes. To rob them rather than beating them. But it's sort of like beating them, right?
Yeah. Yes.
It's like, okay, you have a lot of discretion there.
That's right. And one doesn't know how much of that, how much of what looks like to us like discretion is really because that was included in what they meant by
bodily injury and how much is really a way of saying, well, this is the result we want to get, and so we'll have an excuse for getting it, which surely that is. After all, we've not that long ago had a high-profile U.S. Supreme Court case in which the Supreme Court said, well, despite the fact that the administration said over and over again that this is not a tax, if we call it a tax, it's constitutional, and we want to find it to be constitutional, so after all, the mandate's really a tax. And that's, in a sense, an analogous case, I think. Then, in addition to that, there was doing what ought not to be done, which was a blank check for the court, basically. There was no definition of what that was, but it only allowed relatively low-level punishments. And there was violating an imperial decree, which did not require the existence of the decree, and therefore allowed them to make, I think, administrative punishments for administrative offenses. We see a number of cases in which they're deducing it. For example, if the difference between attempting to murder a slave and attempting to murder a good person, meaning an ordinary level person, is that in other cases, doing something to a slave, the punishment is one level lower than doing it to a good person. Statutes don't happen to mention attempted murder, but will therefore assume that it's like the punishment for attempting to murder an ordinary person, taken one step down. The usual rule, by the way, is when you're taking a step down, it's down by classes of offenses, and up, it's up by within the class. So down would be from life exile to, what's the term, whatever they're calling, forced labor, basically, or from forced labor down to heavy bambooing, whereas up would be from forced labor 1 year to forced labor 2 years. Penal servitude, I think is the term. Another place where they clearly have some flexibility is whether or not they allow special treatment for aged people, for minors, and for only sons who need to stay at home to take care of their parents. And it's clear you don't have a right to have that. The court can decide to give that to you. And there's the whole business of redemption, which is really sort of weird, because redemption is saying, here is the penalty, you can pay a monetary fine instead if we decide to let you. And it looks, if I read this correctly, as though the monetary fines are quite small relative to the punishment. That is, you have something which you would normally have capital punishment, and instead you get to pay the equivalent of about 2 weeks' wages for a workman as your fine, if I've got my numbers right. And there are some cases where it seems to make sense. If you think about the malpractice cases where the doctor is done something wrong and killed the patient, doesn't really feel like murder, but we've got to have a life for a life, so we sentence him to be hanged, to be strangled after the assizes, and then let him pay 12.5 ounces of silver in order to get out of it. That seems, if I read correctly, to be what's happening in that. But there are a lot of cases where, to our mind, we would say this guy obviously deserves special treatment, and he doesn't get it. So that you have a case where a son kills somebody who has just killed his father. But it was the second killing in the same family because a group of relatives attacked him and his father, and killing two people in one family is just a dreadful offense, and therefore they don't give him redemption. They end up imposing severe punishment on him. There's another case where somebody kills a relative, as far as you can tell, unintentionally in the process of stopping him from raping another relative. And again, he ends up getting the punishment. So a lot of that stuff is unclear. And then there's this whole business of the assizes, that all of the capital punishments which occur after the assizes, there are really two more layers of discretion that you can go through before you actually get executed. One of them has to do with the classification of capital offenders into deserving of compassion, or what they are. There are about three different categories. And then for most of those, the process in which their names are written on a sheet of paper, the emperor draws a circle. If you're on the wrong, either inside or outside the circle, we don't know, you get executed, and the other way, you get put back in prison another year, get through it a second time, and for some categories of offense, you now get down to the next level of offense, and you get sent off to life exile, I guess, something like that. So all of that, you do have pretty clearly a system which, in spite of the attempt, what seems like an attempt to reduce discretion, so I have quite a lot of discretion left there.
All right, another interesting question is to what degree did their system allow defenses of the sort we would think of as normal, of things like self-defense, accident, and coercion. And on the one hand, it's clear that the motive for your act has some effect. For example, if the reason you killed the husband was that he was objecting to the fact that you were having an affair with his wife, then you get decapitation before the assizes, whereas if it was just an ordinary premeditated murder, it would be decapitation after the assizes. So the fact that you had a particularly base motive for killing someone means you get an even higher version of capital punishment, one that's real instead of perhaps only theoretical as a result. Accidental killing, which we tend to think of as much less serious, normally has capital punishment, but it can be redeemed if the court's willing to let you. And therefore, in many cases, is really a not very large fine. 12.52 ounces is the figure there. Killing to protect a parent from serious danger is still a capital offense, but it's grounds for appealing to the emperor for a reduction in sentence. So most of this looks as though it's not as we would tend to see it, as you have a right not to be executed if you had a reasonable excuse for your action, but more, well, a merciful government may choose not to execute you on in appreciation of the fact you have. At least that was the impression that I'm getting in those cases. It is not a serious crime if you kill in order to stop a crime, but it is a serious crime if at the point when you kill the person is no longer necessary. So that if someone's attacking someone and you threaten him and he says, "All right, boss, I give up," then you kill him. Now it's murder. Or if you tie him up and then you kill him, now it's murder. So that doesn't seem that unreasonable. And in fact, I don't know if we discussed it, but Jewish law has a somewhat parallel set of rules that you're allowed to kill somebody to prevent killing, the rape of a betrothed maiden. I'm not sure if rape in general, I think not, though I'm not sure. But you're not allowed to kill people if it's not necessary for those purposes. And another interesting issue is to what extent you're obliged to report a crime. What's the legal situation here? If I see a crime and don't report it and it's discovered, have I committed a crime? No. Anybody? People are supposed to be lawyers. You're getting lawyers real soon. Better know whether you've got, are you obliged to it? You see your best friend shoplifting? What?
If you see it committed and don't report it, oh.
Is that, have you committed a criminal offense?
It depends on if you have some special reasons.
So for an ordinary random person, you are not obliged to, is that right? Or not?
I believe we're not obliged to.
Other people know?
I think the closest I remember is, but there's a psychologist, your patient says, "I'm definitely going to kill this person."
If yes.
You got a report. Or, you might be open yourself to conspiracy charge.
Yeah, I think also I think there are also some obligations on doctors who see what they see as evidence of child abuse.
And child and elder abuse.
Yes. One of my hobbies is historical recreation of the Middle Ages and Renaissance. And one of the things people engage in that is combat with medieval weapons using essentially real armor and fake weapons, which sometimes produces bruises. And one occasionally hears stories of some woman who, you know, goes into her doctor who concludes that she's a victim of spousal abuse.
They're not required to report that.
They aren't required to?
No. Unless they're elderly.
Aha, so it's elders or children, but not ordinary people. So if you go into the doctor and it looks as though your husband's beaten you, the doctor doesn't have to tell anybody? And, of course, one interesting argument here, one argument against the requirement, is that the requirement means that if you have been beaten and you don't want your husband to get in trouble, you won't see the doctor.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a flip side of, there are a lot of these cases where if you think about a rule,
a rule does or doesn't
seem to make sense, and then you think about the fact that it has incentives in two different directions. That on the one hand, let me take the case which I've thought about, which is it would be nice if when innocent people are convicted and punished, those responsible for convicting and punishing them themselves got punished for doing it, right? And in some legal systems, to some extent, that happens. But the problem is, if we had a rule which says that if you were the prosecutor, and it is later shown that the person you prosecuted was innocent and got convicted, you'll go to jail, you would go to an awful lot of trouble to make sure that if you did convict innocent people, it never was discovered. And in fact, even short of such a rule, I gather that the DNA, people who do DNA testing, that the what you see from the stuff they write is that very often the people in charge of the prosecution do their best to prevent the testing from happening. This is after the fact. This is you've convicted somebody, you now have an innocent project such as we have or such as other places have. The innocent project says we think he's innocent. We want to get at the DNA samples to get tested, and they normally have often at least have to overcome a lot of resistance to get to do that. You can see it even worse if the final bottom line was you send an innocent man to jail for 5 years, fine, you now go to jail for 5 years.
Yeah, a lot of that is the bad publicity.
Yes, sure. That's right. There's a punishment even if it's not a legal punishment.
Yeah, and even if it's not them who prosecuted the case and it was someone 20 years ago, it still makes their office look bad.
Yep.
Have you ever come across any cases, because I know this is a long time ago and there's not much about like forensics, but is there any crime that you come across for concealing evidence of a crime? I mean, have you ever seen anything calling concealing evidence of a crime?
That's presumably, if you conceal the evidence of your crime, I think that's an additional crime. But I don't know what the, and you might be, again, a conspiracy, but suppose somebody I don't know commits a crime. Let me take the obvious case. I think marijuana should be legal. A complete stranger is smoking marijuana and leaves his stash of marijuana sitting somewhere and the cop is walking towards him, and I kindly knock it with my foot into the stream. Have I committed a crime? It's not a conspiracy in any very sensible sense. I don't know the guy. I'm just trying to prevent the enforcement of a law I disapprove of. That's interesting. How do you people feel in general about the whole issue of laws you disapprove of? I had an exchange online on this question. And the question is, let me take the following case. Suppose you are a judge, and suppose you are quite convinced that marijuana should not be illegal. And somebody has clearly been caught smoking marijuana, and you're in a state where you'll go to jail for 5 years for doing it, which maybe in Texas he might, most states it wouldn't be quite that severe. Is the right thing to do to convict him, or to acquit him even though you know he's guilty? Any opinions? Yeah.
In our ethics, in our lawyer's code of ethics, on the guidelines, they actually say that you're allowed to. If your client wants to break the law, if the lawyer believes that there's a good faith argument that the law should be repealed, then you're not ethically condemned for advising your client on how to do that, to break the law.
That's interesting.
But you do have to, of course, fully explain the consequences and make sure that they understand what they're doing. But as long as you as the lawyer feel that there is a good faith argument that the law is wrong, it should be changed.
Should be changed as opposed to is unconstitutional?
Correct. Should be changed for some reason. Usually it will be constitutional.
What is the difference? Because you see, strictly speaking, if the law is unconstitutional, then it's not really a law. It just seems to be.
Right.
Whereas the law is merely a mistake. It's merely a bad law. I violate a law. The court finds it unconstitutional. I don't get punished. I violate a law. Congress changes it 6 months later. I do get punished.
Right.
So there's a sizable difference between those. But you're saying that even in the second category.
There's no distinction between it has to be an unconstitutional law that just hasn't been repealed yet.
Yes.
At least I didn't come across that. Please, anyone correct me if I'm wrong. But it's just basically that there's a good faith argument wherever it exists.
But it could be a good faith argument that the law should be repealed. It doesn't have to be that it's not a valid law.
It doesn't have to be that it's unconstitutional. At least that's what I saw. Just. You could say that it's so old that it hasn't been enforced anymore, and therefore it's been abandoned, and blah, 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 blah.
What about jury nullification? Anybody have feelings on that?
Yeah.
Imagine you're let me take the equivalent case. You're a juror. It is clear to you that this guy did indeed have marijuana. It is clear to you that smoking marijuana shouldn't be illegal. Do you refuse to convict or not?
Juries aren't instructed. I'm not trying to dominate everyone, but juries are not instructed on their right to nullify. It's,
I understand.
It's horrible. I think it's absolutely abhorrent that we do that, and I think that the juror should be told about
whether he's told, you're a juror, do you think that you should in fact nullify?
Yes.
Let me take the next step. You're a juror. The judge asks you, do you feel willing to rule according to what I tell you is the law? And you know that it's a marijuana case.
Right.
You know, therefore, that you would nullify. Are you obliged to tell the judge the truth and get removed from the jury? Or is the morally proper thing to do to lie to the judge so that you can save this poor person from going to jail?
I think the morally proper thing to do, morally, not legally, is to lie to save the person from going to jail. However, legally, you get in trouble for that.
I'm interested in the moral, not.
Yeah, definitely.
Because now let me, I agree with you, but there's also a problem. That is, agree with you is a little bit strong, because the only time I was close to that case, I in fact didn't lie. I did get removed from the jury. But let me give you what strikes me as the downside of jury nullification. Let us suppose we've got a population where a sizable minority is strongly prejudiced against some group of people, against gays or blacks or foreigners, whatever. Someone kills a member of that group of people. You now can't convict him of murder, because if people believe in jury nullification, the odds are high that at least one person who thinks it's just fine killing people like that will be on the jury and will then vote to acquit.
We have procedural mechanisms in place to deal with that. You can request a change of venue to go outside of that geographical location if you can make a strong enough argument that there is that prejudice and that there is a history of nullification and that you'll never be able to convict. And you can remove the case.
Maybe, but that depends on the prejudice being sufficiently local that you can find a
right.
place where you are not likely to have at least one person on the jury who has that prejudice.
Yes.
Then see, in a sense, this is an example of what strikes me as a more general issue that people tend to ignore, and that is that some statements may be both true and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me the statement that the morally correct thing to do is to nullify is both true and dangerous. It's true in that as long as you are correct in your moral judgment, it's the right thing to do, but it's dangerous because people who are incorrect in their moral judgments will act on the same principle and have bad consequences.
Well, and what you're doing with nullification is you're basically supplanting the legislature's role with
yes.
12 citizens.
With one
then,
citizen.
Well, one citizen technically because...
Things are unanimous in House conference.
But the benefit to that is that you're having the individual facts of a case being explained. Whereas the legislature is just looking at what's going to work, you know, for the majority of people for the majority of the time. So this is more specifically tailored.
Might be, but I'm willing to consider the case where the reason you're nullifying is not the specific of the case, but the fact that you disapprove of the law.
That's true.
I should say, I would go on and I would say that some statements are both true and dangerous, and this is one of them. The statement that the statements are true and dangerous is itself both true and dangerous because it's an argument for suppression of freedom of speech. Anyway, go on, but I think those are issues that, since you're going to be involved with the legal system, you ought to think about. My case was one where somebody was charged with illegally carrying a concealed handgun. And I truthfully told the judge that the author of the most controversial work defending the carrying of concealed handguns was an ex-student of mine, which is true, and that on the whole, I agreed with him. And so, therefore, it's not at all. I might have been on the case, but
so it was a registered gun. It just stated.
I don't know.
Concealed,
I don't know that it would have, but it was reasonably clear that it was somebody I suspect in living in a reasonably dangerous area. He was black, wearing a very nice clothes, but those were for the court, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Who had been found having a concealed handgun. He wasn't. It was. No, it didn't sound from the script as though he'd done anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that if you're in a place where you're in danger, that's a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah.
It's not a legal thing to do. Anyway, so I was removed from the jury for that one. Let me look at some other things. It's worth mentioning that in the Confucian system, there are five relationships with a sort of set of priorities. And relationship between son and parent, or unmarried daughter and parent, is the top level one. And it takes priority over the relationship between subject and ruler, which is interesting. And then subject and ruler is the next, husband to wife, brother to brother, friend to friend. And presumably this is a hierarchy of where your obligations are higher. A general issue that I sort of raised and think is interesting is the role of private parties in how the system works. And on the one hand, within the family, it's clearly supported by the state. It's pretty clear if you look at all of these rules that children can't use the threat of reporting their parents to get the parents, because it's illegal to do so. A parent can have a child exiled to a malarial region, that's the form of the sentence, by complaining of repeated disobedience. And there's a case where the parent then withdraws the complaint, and the person is broken out of imprisonment, and there's an imperial amnesty, and so they decide to let him go back home again. But it's sort of unclear exactly what should happen. Parent could beat the child or husband beat the wife with no legal penalty. Can kill with or without premeditation, without excuse, for 1 year of penal servitude, so it's a penalty but not as serious as a normal murder penalty. If the son was disobedient and the son dies, the 100 blows heavy if the beating was unreasonable, but if the beating was reasonable and the son happens to die, there's no penalty. And there are some periods in which a father can get the officials to authorize his killing and executing the disobedient son. So pretty strong rules along those lines. One interesting effect that would only occur to an economist or apparently somebody in this society is the possibility for gains from trade. Let us suppose that you kill my son. And we're relatives. We know each other. And there's the body. Somebody's got to get convicted of this. And if you're convicted of killing my son, they're going to execute you. Or maybe if you're lucky, you'll go through the assizes a couple of times and go into life exile. But if I am convicted of killing my son, man, nothing at all. Just explain that he was disobedient and so forth and so on. So therefore, you pay me off, and I claim to have done the killing. And there is such a case. One of the cases here is the wife, the mother, not the father, if I remember correctly. Don't worry, that's apparently what's happening as far as you can tell. She's taking the blame for somebody else killing the son for what reasons, I don't remember. The husband killing the wife, if the parents testify that the wife struck or reviled them, the punishment of the husband is 100 blows heavy. On the other hand, if there's no good reason, the punishment is strangulation after the assizes. On the other hand, a son who pushes his parents into suicide through theft or moral turpitude, immediate strangulation is the penalty. And I think I commented on the fact that in a bunch of these cases, somebody committing suicide seems to be treated as something close to somebody being murdered, that pushing someone into suicide is a very serious offense. And I mentioned the case, I looked it up actually afterwards, the Florida case, a couple of years ago maybe, where you have somebody whose roommate sets up a camera to spy on him. He has another man in and they're video kissing. As far as I can tell, that was all that happened. But it was a same-sex encounter of some sort. And a few days later, the video person commits suicide, jumps off George Washington Bridge. As far as I can tell, it was never actually demonstrated that that was the reason. That people conjectured that was the reason. It might have been the reason. It seems like a pretty weak reason on the whole. But there was a big outcry. There were people saying he should be charged with murder. And there was a legislative action in the New Jersey legislature. There was a bill introduced in Congress. The president and several other high administrative officials talked about how terrible this bullying was. It got hugely more attention than it would have gotten if the person hadn't committed suicide. And that struck me as sort of interesting, in that even though I don't think it's in the same sense built into our legal system, you've got the same gut reaction somehow that someone else did it, as it were. The final result was there were actually two people involved. There was the roommate and then a girl who was, I think, in the same dorm. And they watched the video on the girl's computer, because, of course, the guy's computer was in the room where the kissing was happening. And she went and turned state's evidence and got a relatively light sentence for testifying against him. And he got, I think it was 30 days imprisonment, maybe, and a sizable fine, and I think community service or something. I don't remember the details, but it was a punishment which still struck me as way too high for the crime of spying on somebody for 15 minutes. but clearly way too low from the standpoint of people who felt that he pushed somebody to commit suicide. So in that sense, it was somewhere in between. Anyway, I think we're about out of time now. Anything last minute things I want to say? Probably not. More things on my outline, but there's a lot of stuff on China. And I'm going to be spending at least 2 days in China in May, so I will come back knowing probably no more than I now know about the system. What?